Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Market Circle, the makers of Daylight, and by Spotlight Branding, helping to build your internet foundation. I use Daylight as my case management tool. It organizes all my cases, clients, my calendar, to-dos, and emails all in one app that's with me on my Mac, iPhone, and iPad. I use Daylight on my own, but you can also use it in a team. You can use Daylight to track the status of cases, delegate tasks to each other, and see everyone's schedule, all without having to interrupt anyone. Daylight is one of the tools I use to stay organized and increase efficiency. Visit marketcircle.com/daylight to try Daylight for free for 30 days. And be sure to let them know you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount on your first monthly subscription. This episode is also brought to you by my friends at Spotlight Branding. I trust them to manage the internet presence for my law firm, and I recommend them to solo lawyers every chance I get. They built a great website for me, and they use video marketing, social media, email marketing, and more to keep me top of mind with my referral network. Visit spotlightbranding.com to learn more. They're even offering a free gift for podcast listeners, which you can access at spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in The Law Entrepreneur. spotlightbranding.com/TLE, brought to you by our friends at Spotlight Branding. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 50 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host as always. And today for our 50th episode, I wanted to do something a little different. My guest today is Sean McBride. Sean works with business owners that want to lay the foundation first and get their business going in the right direction, or assess where they are and set the stage for a brighter future for their businesses. His goal is to educate his clients so that they understand the law and can make sound decisions on legal matters affecting their business. He's a Maryland boy. He graduated from University of Maryland Law School after attending Towson University for undergraduate program, but now he's transplanted and lives in cowboy country down in Dallas. And he's written a book. His book is called Business Blunders, 10 Dangerous Business Mistakes and How to Protect Your Business So It Can Thrive. And he was kind enough to give me a copy of the book. I read this past weekend in preparation for our interview. And I have to tell you, it really opened my eyes to potential dangers, frankly, that my law firm and those like it might be affected by. So for this episode, Sean is not really a solo practitioner or a small firm. He's actually grown his practice. You'll hear that it's spread out to a number of different locations. And so this gives us an opportunity to think about, as small business owners, as solo practitioners or small firm practitioners, what do we have to pay attention to in order to take our business to that next level? What should we be paying attention to? And as I said, when I went through the book, there were things that I had not given any thought to whatsoever that now my eyes have been opened to. So something different. And I thought that would be appropriate for our 50th episode here on The Law Entrepreneur. And so without any further ado, here is Sean McBride. Welcome, Sean McBride, to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you. Looking forward to this.
I'm glad you could be with us today. Sean, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. You know, I've had a journey in the legal profession like many people. I went to college, studied accounting at first. I knew accounting wasn't kind of what I wanted to spend my entire career doing. But I took a survey course in business law, and it really spoke to me. So I went that direction, went to law school, studied law, focused on business, and came out and joined corporate law firm, and went to three large corporate law firms before eventually deciding that it wasn't quite the appropriate fit for me, and I could probably do more and have more enjoyment with the practice of law by starting my own law firm.
And is that what motivated you to enter solo practice?
Yes, I think, you know, the big law firms are great. I mean, they do amazing work, and I worked on some very interesting cases and learned a lot, but something was missing as far as the size of the client. I was working with very big institutional clients, wasn't working directly with the decision makers. Something wasn't quite there. So I was looking for a little different practice of law and to really be more hands-on with my clients, really make a difference in their lives and their businesses. And that's what drove me more towards the solo side of the world.
Sounds like you were looking for something a little more personal.
Yeah, there was definitely a personal piece that wasn't there. I mean, you were helping these institutions at the big law firm, and you were helping that, but you weren't directly talking to the owner. You weren't directly working with the decision maker, and I really liked that aspect. You know, I'd see glimpses of it at the big law firm, and I think once I started practicing on my own, that became a theme of mine is, you know, being able to work directly with the owner, really adding value, understanding them, having that relationship.
Now, you're currently located in Dallas, is that correct?
That's right. Dallas is my home office.
Has your solo practice always been there?
Yes. I have migrated throughout my life. I was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland boy for a long portion of my life. Wanted to come out of law school. I came out during one of the recessions, and the big law firms just weren't hiring in Maryland, so I went to Wilmington, Delaware, nearby. Spent several years there practicing. As time would have it, I eventually ended up in Washington, D.C. Law firm I work for in Washington, D.C., went out of business during the next recession after that, and I got recruited to Dallas. So I built a contact base within a large law firm in Dallas, and then eventually when it came time to open my solo practice, I had built a contact base that was pretty thriving in Dallas. So that's how I ended up there and starting my solo practice there.
And how long have you been in practice in Dallas?
I've been in Dallas for about 8 years, and I've had my own firm for coming up on 5 years.
Now, as I understand it, you also have an office in New York?
That's right. I have opened an office in New York a couple of years ago based on client demand. I had, you know, been on the East Coast, had some clients up there, and looked at the factors and, you know, decided it made sense to put an associate in New York City. So we hired an associate in New York City who's been working there, working with those particular clients, and then also helping us on other client matters too. So we kind of flow back and forth, work with email and, you know, virtual technology. It's pretty easy to work together and collaborate across the distance.
Yeah. So much so that, as I understand it, you also have of counsel relationships in other state. So while you may be a solo practitioner or kind of started off as a solo practitioner, you've kind of expanded your footprint greatly in the time that you've been on your own.
Yeah, it's now more of a small law firm. I'm not truly a solo because I have other lawyers that are working for my firm, and I have a couple of up-counsel relationships. So it has definitely expanded over time.
And most of that's been driven by client need or looking at a particular market that you want to enter into?
Largely driven by client need, getting feedback on where my contacts are and where things have developed. So my Dallas of counsel, who's now my Austin of counsel, he relocated from one city to the other. For instance, you know, him and I were working together on some securities law matters because I had some additional expertise, and he was a great business lawyer. And we said, well, why don't we work together on more stuff? And that's how that relationship sort of started. So it was largely driven by the types of client engagements we were seeing and capacity issues.
Now, you indicated that, you know, technology is one of the things that's allowed you to kind of expand your footprint. What has been the biggest challenge in you know, creating this expanded practice across geographic locations?
I think the challenges I've had are not just related to the geography, but expansion generally, you know, systems, processes, procedures, having a common way of doing things at a law firm, communication, knowing what each hand is doing. These are real challenges as you start to expand a law firm or a business to make sure that you're doing everything in a coordinated fashion, that you're servicing your clients right. that nothing's falling through the gaps.
And that's true, frankly, if you're doing so, you know, in a single geographic location. Anytime you're expanding, I think the message that we've heard from a lot of our guests is that you need to have systems in place and a way of doing business that's consistent so as to create a common, you know, output and a common viewpoint from the client's perspective.
That's right. The client doesn't want to be caught up in your internal stuff, right? They just want to know that they're being taken care of. They want to know that somebody has their back. They want to know they're being heard. You know, in fact, that's one of the things the team has helped me with a lot, because when it was just me early on, it was hard for me to juggle being in, with a client, being present, working on an issue. And the phone would be ringing, and it would be other clients or potential clients. It would be hard to do that. Now that I have a team, you know, we make sure somebody's generally available to answer the phone. So that way, if a potential client comes in or a client calls with an issue, it's, okay, Sean's in a meeting. You know, he's working with another client or he's in a conference, whatever the case might be. That client rests assured knowing that our office is handling it. They've been heard. It's not getting lost in some voicemail box. Little tweaks like that make a big difference, but that's one of the real advantages of having that team or some virtual technology to simulate that type of experience.
To address the same issue.
Yes.
Now, one of the reasons I'm so pleased to have you on board here is because through the previous 49 episodes of the show, we've kind of explored the successes and practices of solo and small firm practitioners. And you're poised and literally in the process of expanding your firm to that next level. You know, multiple geographic sites and virtual relationships that allows you to create a larger footprint. And I think one of those things that correct me if I'm wrong, that's helped you along the way is I know that you wrote a book. You wrote a book called Business Blunders, The 10 Dangerous Business Mistakes and How to Protect Your Business So It Can Thrive. So this kind of pre-planning with respect to avoiding problems of expansion and growth is something that you've been paying a lot of attention to right from the get-go.
Yeah, exactly. That book has been a way. I mean, it was a project where I was looking for the possibility of getting a book out there, getting some thought leadership, letting people know what we're capable of. And we started seeing certain themes in our clients, people that came to us too late, incoming clients. They had missed issues, they had problems, and that gave us kind of some of the fundamental content for business blunders. And it's been a great tool. It really, people see it. It adds a lot of value. It's kind of a checklist for a business owner. You go through the 10 tips. Many business owners are doing fine on 6 or 7 or 8 of the tips, but there might be 2, 3, or 4 that they can really focus some attention on and really build their business bigger. And so people have loved the content, and it's led to media interviews and other discussions because people love to talk about the book. It gives you something to frame a discussion about and really launching point for going to the next phase.
Well, you were kind enough to provide me with a copy of the book prior to our discussion here today. I went through it over the weekend, and while there are a lot of items in it that might perhaps be more germane to other businesses besides law firms, I was struck by how many really do pertain to law firms themselves and how the problems they may experience through their growth and development.
Yeah, it's been very interesting as I've grown my business. You know, I've of course been looking for ways to make my business run more efficiently and do more. And that leads to me talking to other business owners, both lawyers and non-lawyers and accountants and even operating businesses. And you'd be shocked how common many of the issues are between running a law firm and running a manufacturing firm. You know, the employee issues, the organizational issues, the documentation issues. A lot of the issues, we think that we're very unique because we're lawyers and we're having these challenges because we're lawyers running law firms. But these are business owners having businesses problems that we face. So as I've worked more and more and talked more and more to other business owners, a lot of these issues, they transcend different areas of industry or practice.
Well, and I'm struck by that. And I'm just going to go down a couple of these and have you comment on them. You know, first point is change in ownership structure. And we see that with a lot of solo practices, people who start out as a solo or maybe start off in a partnership with another attorney and then things change. And talk a little bit about the pitfalls and how to avoid problems with regard to changes in ownership of a law firm.
Yeah, well, they're going to happen. We know that. Every partnership is temporary in some way, shape, or form. As somebody's eventually going to die, or somebody's going to want to leave the partnership, or some move is going to happen. So the mere fact that we have a partnership tells us that we are going to have the possibility of changes, whether it's forced upon us or not. So we want to be realistic about that. We know the owners are going to change at some point. We know that likely those owners are going to take the economic value with them or transfer to their family or other heirs. So we just need to be realistic about that and have ways to have people come in and come out so that the business continues, the value is protected, nobody ends up taking a huge loss, and everybody's treated fairly. And you set that up at the beginning, because if you wait until somebody's ready to leave, then it really becomes an ugly negotiating situation and the business hangs in the balance.
So what kind of tools or what kind of products would you recommend attorneys have in place to protect them in that area?
This is starting from the beginning. When you set up your entity, whatever it is, you know, you need to have that first. You need to set up what are we going to be? Are we an LLC? Are we a corporation, you know, a professional version thereof, depending on the state you're in? Or are we going to operate as a general partnership and take the risk? Once you figure out kind of your legal structure, then you want to bake this into the documentation. So you want this into your agreements. We work with our clients. You know, we put that into their operating documents, certain provisions that deal with the buyout and exit of partners and how that would work. And we put those provisions in there to make that happen.
My sense is that on more than, you know, a single occasion, that attorneys are, quote, partnering up, but really operating as separate entities, and the partnership is, I'm putting in air quotes here, is really just the name on the door.
Mm-hmm.
There's a risk with that, is there not?
There's a great deal of risk with that, you know, and I think we can probably all vaguely remember those law school cases where courts have come in there and deemed people to be a partnership based on their actions, based on their statements. And of course, if you have a partnership which is not formed as a limited partnership or otherwise a legally recognized entity, and sometimes we use the word partnership, you know, with LLCs or corporations because they're economic partners. But if you're not within an economic entity, if we're not within a legal entity and we're operating as partners, particularly if we're using that word partners, the court may very well deem that you are indeed general partners. So you're partners in an unregistered entity, unincorporated entity, which means unlimited liability for all partners for any partnership activities. So if partner A commits malpractice, partner B and partner C have unlimited personal liability for that malpractice, which is a very bad result. So there's a lot of risk involved there. So yes, you want to be very careful when you're working with others, especially if you're using the term partnership, you're calling yourself a partnership, very careful about that. And even if you're not using the word partnership, if you're acting kind of in that way or letting other people think that you have something bigger than just you, your solo practice, you've got these other people you're working with, that client might realistically believe that you're a partnership, and then they may try to go for a broader base of liability if something bad happens.
Well, that leads me to the next point in your book. It's a little further down the list, but you talk about plugging the leaks in your business. And I looked at that as meaning separating your business activities from your personal activities. Chat about that for a moment.
Yeah, sure. That is key. You know, a lot of people and our clients often make this mistake. They think just because I formed an LLC or I formed a corporation that I'm going to have limited liability, I don't have to think about it anymore. I filed that paper with the state. I'll stick that in my file drawer. And we've got limited liability. If anything bad happens, I'm going to pull that piece of paper out of the drawer and we're not going to have to pay anything. But the court cases come down and say it takes a little more than that. You have to act like an entity. You have to act like a business. You have to have your separate checking account, do the proper accounting, hold yourself out as an entity, you know, sign your engagement letters with the entity, not with you personally. And a lot of people, small business owners, small law firms, make that mistake. They don't distinguish between their personal capacity and their business capacity and their entity. So we want to be very careful in all of our documentation to be clear when we're acting for ourselves, when we're acting for our business, and where the line is drawn between the two.
Yeah, one of the areas that I see this, I think I see this most frequently from some of our guests that have been on the show is how you sign your retainer agreement. Mm-hmm. You know, physically, how you put your signature on the retainer agreement.
That can be your first hole in this chain. If you sign that retainer agreement with your own name and say that you're the one that's entering into it, then you've created a very good argument that you have personal liability, because that client can come back to and point to and say, I signed an agreement with attorney X. I didn't sign an agreement with XYZ law firm.
Even though it was on the law firm's letterhead.
That's right. Yeah. And then we see this with our corporate clients too. People, you know, they don't think about the signature blocks, and there's a lot of different forms of signature blocks out there. A lot of them are wrong. You want to make sure that it's very clear that the contracting party is the law firm or the entity, not the individual.
Right. We talked a little bit about this before when we were talking about changing ownership structure, but exit strategy is something else that attorneys ought to be looking at from the beginning as they develop their business.
Absolutely, yeah. You're building value, right? As you're building this law firm, and of course, many of us talked about the struggles of growing a business. That's, you know, one of the common themes I see sometimes on the lawyer threads is, you know, how difficult it is to get this ball rolling and get it going. But many lawyers find at some point the ball does start rolling. You start building a client base. Well, some of the value of that client base is going to be immediate billings, you know, billings this year, billings next year, paying your salary, allowing you to live the life you want to live. But there's also some value in that brand, in that client loyalty, in that service you're providing in this bigger firm. So if you start with an exit mindset, you know, someday I'm not going to be practicing law. How do I make this continue? And if you build that bigger firm and you build that value and you get the right people involved, there might be some more economic value there for you. And if you have that proper exit plan started, and if you start it early, it becomes much more realistic for you to build this asset. You possibly can sell to another lawyer as you're exiting practice.
This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Market Circle, the makers of Daylight. As I mentioned, I use Daylight as my case management tool, as it organizes all my cases, clients, my calendar, to-dos, emails, all in one app. And it's with me everywhere because it's on my Mac, my iPhone, and my iPad. If I get a call from a client when I'm out of the office, I can quickly pull up the details of the case on my iPhone and then jot down some notes after the call, and it's all organized in Daylight. I use Daylight by myself on my own, but you can also use it in a team. You can track the status of cases, delegate tasks between one another, and check everyone's calendars, all without having to interrupt anyone or dig through papers. It really streams your workflow so you can work more efficiently. Managing email is a big part of how Daylight helps me. It integrates with Apple Mail, so as I'm going through my emails, I can just click and save emails to a client or to a case. That way, when I'm looking at the case details, I can see a history of all the emails with the client or any notes that I've taken and follow-ups with them all in one spot. So visit marketcircle.com/daylight to try Daylight free for 30 days. And be sure to let them know you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount on your first monthly subscription. In addition, I want to tell you about my friends at Spotlight Branding. I trust them to manage the internet presence for my law firm, and I recommend them to solo lawyers every chance I get. They build a great website for me, and they use video marketing, social media, email marketing, and more to keep me top of mind with my referral network. And this helps me generate more referrals and more business for my firm. Their services are designed to help lawyers get better results out of the resources they're already investing into marketing and business development. They create an internet foundation that makes all of your marketing work better. That's because these days, almost every potential client is going to check out your web presence before they hire you. It's important that you create a strong first impression. And that's what Spotlight Branding has done for me, and they can do it for you too. So visit spotlightbranding.com to learn more. They're even offering a free gift for our podcast listeners, which you can access at spotlightbranding.com/TLE. I noted in the book that one of the questions that you raise was to decide in the beginning what your exit strategy is going to be.
Yes. You're going to want to know early in the process how you're going to exit the business.
I know that's a question I haven't answered myself.
Yeah, well, it's okay. A lot of people haven't answered it, but the sooner you can get, kind of come around and answer and coalesce around what you might want to do, the better you're going to be.
Because I'm reading into this that if you're building a firm with the idea that someday your exit strategy is going to be selling the firm, that's one approach, and that's going to drive you in one direction. Whereas if you think, I'm going to build a firm and I want it to be a legacy business such that if I pass, the firm continues in some capacity and provides income to my family, that's a different strategy altogether.
Completely different structure internally, different things, and that's going to affect how you interface with vendors, some of those contracts and other agreements. It's going to pervade your business depending on which strategy you want and how you position the business and how you get it ready. You know, whether it's I'm going to build this for 10 years and sell it to another lawyer, or whether I'm going to build it up and bring in a junior partner and teach them how to run the business and they're going to buy me out over a long period of time. Those are going to be different business structures, and they're going to have different ways of doing your documents internally, different ways of interfacing with your vendors, different ways of interfacing with your clients. And the sooner you know that, the more you can direct your business that way.
But that's not to suggest that your view or your goal might not change over time, right?
Absolutely. Life changes, you know, and that's one of the things we talked about with the we talked about partnership changes earlier, comes back home here. People's values are going to change. So within a partnership, they're going to change. And with even a solo firm, your desires, your wants, they may change over time. So you want to be realistic and know that just because I'm here today and I'm pointing that direction, you know, something might change. My values might change. Some events might happen. Sometimes it's family. It's medical events. Different things happen to change people's direction a little bit. So be flexible. Know that, you know, you can adapt. You don't have to pick an answer now, but if you know which direction you're headed, you're much more likely to get where you're going.
Now, one of the things that we want to protect along the lines of ensuring that there's value in the business that we create is intellectual property. And I think that at times we think as lawyers that we're not creating intellectual property at the same degree that, say, a business that's, you know, manufacturing products is. But in your book, you argue just the opposite, that law firms do have intellectual property that they need to protect throughout the course of their business.
Yeah, I think if you're being great at what you're doing, if you're building a really good law firm, there's got to be something unique, something that's different about your law firm than the others. It could be as simple as your location. You know, I offer this service in this particular geography, and there's no other lawyer of my quality that offers this service. But you're probably looking for something more, some subject matter expertise, some knowledge base that maybe not everybody has, that a very small percentage of the bar has. That's what's going to attract clients to come into you. And that is a piece of intellectual property. How you express it is the next question, whether it's in a book, whether it's in articles, whether it's in trademarked materials where you're using certain branding elements. You can think about how that comes together, but you're probably creating intellectual property along the way. And one of the most valuable pieces of your intellectual property might be something you're not even thinking about, which is your client list.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's sitting there in a computer file somewhere. You have a list of all these clients that you've interfaced with, and that may have great value, you know, another law firm to a potential acquirer in the future or other things, assuming you do all this within the ethical guidelines. But there's value to knowing who these people are, the fact that they've needed your legal services in whatever area in the past, and they probably will have needs in the future. So there's lots of pieces of intellectual property that are sitting there around your business that you're probably not even thinking about.
Yeah, I'm just thinking as you were talking about that, in terms of client lists, for those of us who are continually marketing to our former clients and have built up systems to do that, I'm thinking specifically of, you know, email campaigns and the like. I suppose that potentially increases the value of that intellectual property, aside from just having a Rolodex of names and addresses.
Oh, certainly. The more engaged you are with the clients, the more they understand who you are, the more they like you, the more they refer to you, that's certainly going to be more valuable. You know, if I'm a law firm that's acquiring another law firm, and those days haven't come for me yet, but they may come someday. If I'm on that acquirer side, I'm going to be looking at, you know, is this an engaged client base? Is it just a list of names and numbers, or is it people that they've built a relationship with? If you've been emailing them and sending them newsletters and cultivating that relationship, and they send you occasional referrals, that's a much more valuable client list than a client list that's just a list of people you've done business with in the past.
So the message there is we need to protect that property.
Definitely. You want to make sure, you know, with your employees, obviously, you know, your administrative staff, you want to make sure that they, you know the confidentiality of this. They don't take those lists and sell them to other people. You also want to cultivate those lists carefully, you know, build them over time. Maybe do, you know, some people have recommended you do a paper mailing a couple of times a year. That's going to make sure that your physical mailing address stay up to date. And if you get bounced back mail, then you know that person's moved and you can update your mailing list. A lot of things you can do to really, you know, if we're focusing on that customer list, you can really, you know, keep the value of it up over time by doing some maintenance. And that's something you want to be very intentional about if you know that that's going to be part of your exit. You know, we've talked about the exit before. That's probably connected in there. So now build the value of that asset for that exit.
One of the, I thought, more interesting chapters of your book had to do with advisory boards. And I will confess that I never thought about creating an advisory board for a law firm, but a friend of mine who specializes in doing just that, not necessarily for law firms, but for other businesses, was talking to me the other day and asking whether or not that's a common practice in small firms or emerging firms to build an advisory board. What are your thoughts on along those lines?
I don't think it's become a common thing to do. I have not seen too many law firms do it. But what I do know is that my non-law clients, my business clients, you know, when they put these types of organizations together, when they use an advisory board, when they bring in outside advice, they're amazed by the value they get. It helps them tighten their positioning. It helps them think more about what value they're adding to their clients. It helps them see opportunities they hadn't seen. It helps them direct their business. So I think there's a great opportunity here for law firms, particularly small law firms. That solo law firm, you're in there so much in the day-to-day, so much used to the way you've seen it. You need to be exposed to other ways of doing things, the ways that other people are having success, understanding how the whole system ties together. That's going to allow you to do more.
Well, what struck me is that as we, as solos, build referral networks, and the referral networks are segmented sometimes by occupation. So, for instance, as an estate planning attorney, I have a group of financial planners that I work with. I have a group of accountants that I try and cultivate. I have a group of general practitioner doctors and the like. And I was thinking that in terms of bringing added value to those potential referral sources, inviting the key one or two to sit on an advisory board for my law firm might be something that would help establish that relationship in a more productive way, and also be of value to me in terms of seeing the expertise that they bring to the table.
I think it's a very good compliment when you ask somebody to be on your advisory board. You're telling them, I care about you. I believe in what, you know, your abilities. I think that you have valuable insights. So that's great. It builds a bridge. And it shows that you want to service them better. So I think it's a great way, if you have the right relationship with somebody, by inviting them on the advisory board, you can deepen that relationship. Now, the risk is you got to be vulnerable. You're going to have to share some dirty laundry. If you're using your advisory board correctly, you're going to show them not only the great things about your firm, and you're going to talk about the fun things about your firm, but you're going to talk about some of the problems you're having, some of the struggles you're having. So you need to then be able to have that vulnerability with that key contact too, or client.
And there needs to also be a reciprocal reason as to why they may want to assist you as an advisor.
Exactly. I mean, it deepens that relationship, and they may want to know that, you know, you're dealing with issues, and they may be fine with that. You know, assuming, again, the relationship's deep enough and there's enough trust there, they know you're going to get through whatever the issue is, that really shows how much you care about your clients and you care about your business. So it can be really positive. But if you have a surface level relationship and you put somebody on the advisory board and you start talking about an issue you're having with a particular employee, they might get scared that their file is going to get hurt or damaged by that employee, and they may want to, you know, they may prematurely run away. So you want to make sure you have the right level of relationship.
Sure. Now, one of the things that I think comes out with most law firms as they start out is they realize that they have to have malpractice insurance. They have to insure against the risk of something going wrong. But again, when I read your book, it broadened my thinking to realize that there's more risk to be mitigated through insurance than malpractice alone.
That's absolutely right. You know, you've got other business risks. We are businesses, and malpractice is the big one. Obviously, that's the huge dollar ones. That's the ones that really get the attention.
But, and the ones that help you keep your license.
Yes, of course. But the client may slip and fall at your office.
That just jumped right out at me.
Yeah, it could happen.
And I suppose that for those of us who are leasing space from a landlord, we would come under their liability policy, but I'm not 100% sure about that.
No, it really depends on the policy.
I never asked.
Yeah, most of the time they're going to try to exclude that. They're going to say, you know, I'm going to cover the common areas and that kind of stuff. You're going to have to cover that. And many leases actually say that you're the tenant are responsible for insuring your particular space within the larger building. So
if a client tripped on a throw rug that you put down in your suite.
Yeah, you've got a negligence suit, you know, and then you've got to prove, you know, all the standard stuff that a personal injury lawyer would go through. You know, was the care proper? Did you, you know, was it foreseeable, et cetera? So you've opened yourself up to a potential lawsuit. And it'd be great to have some insurance there to help you with that and to protect you if things go the wrong direction.
And I think you also mentioned in the book, officer and...
directors and officer insurance some people call it errors and omissions insurance. But yes, that's something, you know, if you get to a more formal, bigger firm and you're going to have actual directors of your law firm, those directors may indeed want to have insurance policies to cover their actions. To make sure that, you know, if whatever action they take, they're covered in that somebody challenges that action or wants to sue them.
And then the other point that you raised was personal insurance on your behalf if you're traveling for business purposes.
Right. Again, you know, that's another one of those pieces of insurance. You want to make sure you have the proper insurance for yourself. If you're traveling, you know, if you're renting a car, you know, make sure that there's that tricky divide between business use of the car, personal use of the car. A lot of times your personal policy won't cover it with a business use. So you want to make sure that however you're structuring this, that you've got coverage in place so that you're protected.
It was a real eye-opener for me, Sean. I really had not thought of the places where risk existed beyond just malpractice coverage.
We're businesses, you know, and we have stuff. And it could be, you know, cyber liability is a big one now, too. You know, what if somebody gets on the internet and hacks and steals your files and does something malicious with them? You know, who takes responsibility for that? There's insurance available for that, too. So there's a world of risk out there. You probably want to sit down with a good insurance agent, talk about the nature of your business and how your business is really operating, and they can point out what policies you need.
A lot of this all really comes down to great record keeping.
Yeah,
you know, it seems to me like you want to be aware of these potential pitfalls, and then you want to have, you know, fabulous records in place to protect yourself down the road.
That's right. Record keeping is so critical, and it's not a fun thing. I mean, nobody says, you know, well, very few people say, "My God, I want to go keep great records. I want to organize all this stuff." You know, particularly a busy attorney that's got a lot of stuff going on, you know, you, the last thing you want to do is organize even more records. You've got your case files to organize, but you got business records to organize too. Keeping that stuff organized is going to protect you in a lawsuit because you'll have those records of notices. You know, maybe you have the files where you know, going back to the malpractice side of the equation, you have those files where you met with a potential client but didn't take the case. Well, you keep that file record saying, you know, I'm not representing you. You should go seek other counsel. Keeping all that organized in the file is going to be a great protection in the event of a lawsuit. you know, notifying a client of a statute of limitations, great protection, all those kind of things you can do to paper your files, keep all your contracts and agreements. If you get into an acquisition situation where another law firm is looking to buy your law firm sometime down the line, if you can show them, here's my contracts with my vendors, here's everything is in order, you know, you don't have any issues, my lease can be terminated within 6 months. These are the kind of things they're going to be curious about when they're acquiring your business, because they want to lock down the economic value, understand what contracts are going to stay, which contracts are going to go. And if you have all that organized, you're going to get more value for your business.
Clearly. But in the end, I think you make the point at the end of your book that despite mitigating risk through insurance and great record keeping and thinking all these potential pitfalls through from the very beginning, that we need to plan on litigation at some point in time, because that's part of the cost of doing business.
Absolutely. You know, we all know how easy it is for people to file lawsuits, meritorious lawsuits, non-meritorious lawsuits. You know, everybody has the right to go to the courthouse. And if you're on the responding side, it's your job to go the other direction and get that lawsuit to end. So you got to know, you know, that that's potentially going to happen at some point, and you've got to really build up for the possibility that unfortunately somebody may sue you. So even if you keep the great records, you have the insurance, you could still end up in a lawsuit situation. So be prepared and know that that may be something you face at some point in your business. You're going to put some time and energy into it.
Yeah. And what I got out of that is that you may also want to create a monetary fund and contribute to that along the way so that you have that nest egg to fall back on if you need it.
I think that's absolutely right. It's that monetary fund, and it's that strength in your business. You know, I think some people kind of get to a comfort point. They say, I've got enough clients, I've got enough business, I'm doing okay, I don't need to stretch anymore. And you want to have that safety factor there. You need to have a little bit plus so that you know that in the event that lawsuit comes, you know, you've got enough, your operations are sizable, your profit margins are sizable enough that you can stop and spend that time and energy on that lawsuit, or you have that monetary fund sitting there, you know, to jump in there and let you pay those costs and expenses or take that time away from your practice.
Well, Sean, listen, I think this has been fantastic. I really do appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. And I want to let you know personally that having read the book, I sat there over the weekend and thought about there's blunders that I'm making that I didn't even know I was making. Questions that I need to ask myself that I didn't even contemplate. And I've been in, you know, practice for 10 years now. So I think the book is a very valuable tool. And why don't you give our listeners your contact information, how they can reach out to you if they want to follow up and maybe get a copy of their book themselves.
Sure. Yeah, the book, if you go to www.mcbridebook.com, it will have some basic information on the book and will also direct you to Amazon where you can order a copy of the book. And if you want to get a hold of me, www.mcbrideattorneys, that's plural, mcbrideattorneys.com.
And that's McBride, M-C-B-R-I-D-E, right?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll have that in the show notes as well.
So feel free to reach out to me through that website as well.
Terrific. Well, Sean, again, thanks for being with us today. I think it's great food for thought as we go forward trying to build our solo practices into thriving businesses. And I'm for sure going to benefit from avoiding these 10 dangerous business mistakes as defined in your book. So thanks ever so much for writing the book and for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Once again, I'd like to thank our friends at Market Circle, the makers of Daylight and Spotlight Branding, for being sponsors of today's podcast. Market Circles, as the makers of Daylight, provide the tool that I use to manage my cases, my clients, my calendar, my to-dos, the emails, and they do so all in one app that stays with me on my Mac, my iPhone, and my iPad. I use Daylight on my own in a solo environment, but you can also use it in a team. You can use Daylight to track the status of cases and delegate tasks to one another on your team, and you can see everyone's schedule all without having to interrupt anyone. Daylight is one of the tools that I use to stay organized, and it increases my efficiency, and therefore it only stands to reason that it'll do the same for you and your team if you use it in a broader environment. So visit marketcircle.com/daylight to try Daylight free for 30 days. And be sure to let them know that you heard about Daylight through the Law Entrepreneur in order to get a 50% discount on your first monthly subscription. Also, our friends at Spotlight Branding, as always, have been very helpful in sponsoring this podcast. You know, I trust them to manage the internet presence for my law firm, and I recommend them to solo lawyers every chance I get. They built a great website for me, and they use video marketing, social media, email marketing, and more to help keep me top of mind with my referral network. So visit www.spotlightbranding.com to learn more. They're even offering a free gift for podcast listeners, which you can access at spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur. So spotlightbranding.com/TLE to access your free gift. And as always, make sure that you visit our website, www.thelawentrepreneur.com, to see everything that's going on with the podcast and subscribe to our newsletter so that you can stay in the know and be the first on your block, so to speak, to gain insight into what's going on here. So once again, thanks for being here this time around. I appreciate your listenership. Hope to see you again next week on The Law Entrepreneur.